from Shroud University. This is Russ Brialde bringing you another podcast on the Shroud of Turin, the greatest mystery in the known world.
In July, when I received an invitation from Isabel to be the keynote speaker at this conference, first I asked, well, why it ought to be me when there are so many eminent Shroudies who could have done it. It may be that when a speaker with an English accent addresses a largely American audience, it's the sound and the pronunciations which intrigue them, so it doesn't much matter what you say. It's only the way that you say it. But whatever the reason, here I am, because as you know, a request from Isabel becomes an order which one refuses at one's peril. The Shroud in the New Millennium. Ladies and gentlemen, this important international conference represents one of those pivotal moments in the history of the Shroud and Sindonology. And I therefore regard this opportunity to deliver a keynote address here in wonderful Dallas, Texas, a very great honor indeed. In doing so, I would first like to extend on behalf of all of us here, I think, every member of this assembled company, our gratitude to the organizers of the conference for the work that they've done, exhibiting the energy, the vision, and the foresight to provide such an enjoyable and intimate forum in this vibrant city of Dallas and the state of Texas, known all over the world as it is for its hospitality, congeniality, and the warmth of its welcome, and for allowing the continuation of our vital collective work towards a better understanding of the Shroud of Turin. You have provided us with a magnificent opportunity for information exchange and the expression of our ideas, our research, our hypotheses, the results we've achieved, and most importantly, I believe, our celebration of friendship and our spirit of common purpose, which binds us, reflecting those intangible qualities which are revealed whenever we come together, whatever, wherever it may be in the world, to share our knowledge and our work regarding this enigma, this extraordinary object, this perpetual mystery, the Shroud. I congratulate Tom DeMahala and the American Shroud of Turin Association for Research, AMSTAR, and also the very Reverend Fred Brinkman and the Shroud Guild on their joint staging of this magnificent conference. And we must especially thank the principal organizers, our valued and trusted friends, the genial Michael Miner and the inimitable Isabel Pikchek. And I would also like to say how much I think we've all appreciated the work that Barry Schwartz has done. I mean, many people have worked behind the scenes, but he's been there for every minute of every part of this conference, working all the technical things. And I'm also highly delighted that you had the foresight to invite our friend Mario Trematore to be here as a very special guest, because if it wasn't for him, I suggest that none of us would be here, because we'd have nothing further to talk about. At the very outset, I would like to add my own sentiments to those which have already been expressed by others in this gathering regarding the recent events which have taken place in your beloved America. You have faced appalling acts of aggression and terror. Your citizens have been victims of atrocity and slaughter. We, as citizens of the free world who share a common bond, uniting free peoples all over the world, share deeply in your distress. We feel as you do, the terrible sadness and the sense of loss which your nation has faced, and we mourn these losses as you do. We share equally your resolve to rid the world of terror and to face down despicable cowards and to triumph over the evil manifest in their barbaric actions. I want to thank you for having the courage and the strength of mind to continue with this vital international conference, which celebrates so clearly a message of goodness and hope in the world despite these troubled times. And I can tell you that the people of my own adopted country, Australia, are standing firmly at your side, ready to take up the challenges which lie ahead, facing all free peoples in ridding the world of brutal terrorism. By standing firm as you have done in going ahead with this conference, you bring strength to the message of hope in the world at this time. that essential message which shows us that good does win out over evil in the end, and that what we know to be good and right will endure in the world. The message of the Shroud itself is proof enough of that. This conference represents then a pivotal moment in the history of the Shroud, for we're given the opportunity through accident of time, date and calendar in this millennial year to take stock of the events in Shroud history of the past two millennia and of Syndonology in the past century. We are also given the opportunity to look forward, to redefine our hopes and dreams as Shroud researchers in the light of what we've already learnt about the Shroud. We have a unique opportunity, and many are already embracing it, to advance with a fresh outlook, a renewed spirit, a strengthened desire, to work together asking the questions of science, religion, history and art, which might yet reveal answers to the unresolved issues surrounding the Shroud. In February 1997, I wrote in the 100th issue of Shroud News, I wrote that of my own Shroud Odyssey, as I called it, which began in Turin in August 1978, when I first saw the Shroud, the day before the public were admitted into the cathedral for the great exposition of that year. And that odyssey became more and more intense as the years went on. It became a commitment for me to continue to bring out that Shroud News, whose first issue appeared in 1980. And I watched the subscription list grow and widen to embrace people in all countries all over the world. I noted at the time that I didn't have any real editorial policy, no mission statement of any significance, no editorial board with individuals pressing their own opinions on the publication, no initial requirement for peer review, and therefore, if I may say so, allowing an important immediacy of information. No deadline to meet, apart from the approximate bi-monthly production, which I have to admit has been a little flexible in the last year or two, and no pretensions about being a scholarly or scientific or prestigious publication. For these reasons, Shroud News became a success and filled a void in communication amongst Shroudies in many places. It was very evident to me at the outset that effective communication is and always will be a key to the success and viability of Syndonology as a whole. A further and very contemporary example of this need for effective communication amongst Shroud scholars can be observed in the remarkable development and significance of the superb internet website generated over thousands of hours by Barry in the last few years, which brings immediacy to the current news and developments amongst Syndonologists and provides access to our work for the interested general public all over the world. The websites of Schwartz and the many others who've been developed are essential in the sharing of information as our collective research programs continue in the new millennium. In 1997, I wrote, if the anti-Shroud crusade and skeptics had never put up their absurd theories, and if the world media, ever keen for a scandal and for negative reporting, had not taken up, for example, the forgery story of Walter McCrone, and had continued to beat it up for the entire period since 1980, then perhaps the intensity with which those of us who had read all the other research and who understand the implications of the enormous preponderance of evidence for probable authenticity would not have occurred. And I also said in that same year, I've no personal reason for wanting the Shroud to be genuine. What I do know is that when I first saw it in 1978, it became immediately apparent to me, like any other self-evident truth, that it must surely be genuine. Although I could not then, I cannot now, and I do not expect in the future to be able to prove that statement. It was certainly a purely subjective attitude formed in my mind by the evidence of my eyes, my other senses, and above all, my third eye. And whilst I've always been ready to be convinced that it's a fake, no one has yet been able so to convince me by outweighing that vast body of evidence to the contrary. It's been a fascinating 20-odd years delving into the numerous areas of research and interest. I've been able to meet and befriend many of the world's great Syndonologists, and then through Shroud News to pay tribute to the large number of them who've died during that period when my little magazine first started. The first great generation of 20th century Shroudies has then almost disappeared. I belong to the second wave, and I'm no longer young. My earnest hope, shared by many, is that we shall find enough of the third wave of syndonologists to persist with the work and carry into the next millennium, or this millennium and the next, the continuing quest for more information, investigation, and discussion about this most fascinating mystery in the world. When we gathered here, all of like mind, think back over the past 20 or 30 years, and further, indeed, to the dawning of the scientific age for the Shroud of Turin, which began with Secundo Pia and his great cumbersome plate camera in 1898, I think we'd all agree that one of the most rewarding aspects of the exercise has been in those friendships and collaborations which we've made along the way. And this is particularly true for me, as I've had the opportunity of moving freely amongst the worldwide Shroud Circle for many years. There is, as with most fields of study, a special affinity which is manifest amongst those of the same mindset. There are also to be observed, unfortunately, the less noble human failings of academic jealousies, of occasional backbiting and personal vendettas and scandals, and in some cases almost criminal activity, which attends upon all intensive and passionate human behaviour. Now, I've tried to keep clear of these, and I hope I've been successful, apart from the frustration or annoyance which I might have caused occasionally to those who cannot face candour. I've had the great pleasure and privilege of attending and giving papers at a number of international Shroud conferences. I've managed to write several books on the subject and to be involved one way or another with the production of others. I've given many lectures on the Shroud, as you have, to public groups, and I have since 1982 had control of the original Brooks Institute photographic exhibition based on the 1978 research work in Turin, and have added to and enhanced that exhibit. It has been seen, in fact, by nearly 750,000 people in many countries since that time, and I've enjoyed the challenge of doing several pieces of original research and have been a member of a number of expeditionary teams undertaking research in the field of one kind or another. Now, as a prelude to considering the challenges of the future and to put into perspective the present, let us ponder then briefly some of the major events which have shaped syndonology in the scientific era of Shroud history, which began, as we all know, in 1898. In that year, Pia's photographs revealed the Shroud image to have the same characteristics as a photographic negative. In 1902, you'll remember, the first modern scientific paper on the subject of the Shroud was presented to the Academy of Sciences in Paris by the professor of anatomy, Yves Delage, who argued for the medical and general scientific plausibility of the Shroud image. In 1931, 2 million visitors flocked to see the exhibition of the Shroud in Turin. Giuseppe Henrier photographed it, and Secondo Pia was there as well as scientists of the French Academy. In the same year, Pierre Barbet conducted experiments to reconstruct the Passion of Jesus as exhibited on the Shroud, and that's just been updated by Dr. Fred Zugby at this conference. In 1933, Father Peter Rinaldi attended the exposition of the Shroud. Barbet, through direct dose observation, realized that the blood stains were derived from direct contact between cloth and body. In 1938, Fignon, who'd studied the Shroud for many years, published the most definitive book on the subject to that time. And much of our later work has been in verifying the hypotheses put forward by him. In 1939, the first International Congress on Shroud Studies was held in Turin, at which 20 papers were presented, and which was the forerunner of all international conferences such as this one that we are attending in Dallas. In 1951, the Holy Shroud Guild was formed in New York. In 1969, Cardinal Pellegrino initiated an examination of the Shroud to study its state of preservation by a team of experts. In 1969, the Shroud was photographed by Giovanni Battista Giudica Cordelia in colour for the first time, and again in black and white, and by Woods Light and Ultraviolet. In 73, the Shroud was exhibited for television, and a group of international syndonologists was enabled to examine it. And this included the removal of a significant sample by Professor Gilbert Grace and the removal of 12 adhesive tape samples by Dr. Max Fry. In 76, Dr. John Jackson and Bill Motton viewed a Shroud image through a VP8 imager analyzer for the first time, revealing the three-dimensionality of the image. In 76, Max Fry demonstrated that some pollens found on the Shroud were unique to Israel and to Turkey. In 77, Fathers Rinaldi and Otterbein Sox and Robinson, Rolfe and Jackson, and many others met at the first United States Conference of Research on the Shroud, and the Shroud of Turin Research Project, STIRP, team later evolved as a result of this meeting, and as we know, there are three or four members of the original STIRP team here with us. In 78, Cardinal Balestrero announced a Shroud exposition and international congress for later that year. The team, which became STIRP, met in Colorado Springs and again in Connecticut to plan scientific testing for the Shroud. Harry Gove met Edward Hall, who just died recently, incidentally, Hall, to discuss carbon dating of the Shroud. The second international symposium on the Shroud was held in Turin. In 78, Ian Wilson's book became the most significant book on the subject to that date, in which particularly his hypothesis that the folded Shroud and the framed Mandylion of Edessa are one and the same. In October 78, STIRP carried out its extensive battery of tests. A complete photographic study was undertaken by Vernon Miller and Barry Schwartz and Ernie Brooks, amongst others. An independent research program was undertaken by Fry and Rigi, Bima Bologna, Gonella, and others. Ray Rogers took 32 samples of particulate matter removed from the Shroud surface by Fry to microscopist Walter McCrone. In 79, the film The Silent Witness was released by David Rolfe in England. In the same year, Father Frank Philas first identified the coin images on the eyes. In 81, Brooks Institute exhibited photographic material from the 1978 study. In 81, Jackson, Schwalbe, Gonella, Otterbein, and Rinaldi visited ex-King Umberto of Italy to report initial findings of the STIRP investigations to the Shroud's owner. In 83, King Umberto died, and the Shroud was bequeathed to the Pope. In 84, Jackson and de Mahala presented Cardinal Balestrero with proposals for further scientific work on the Shroud. In 86, the United States group, the Association of Scholars and Scientists International for the Shroud of Turin, ASSIST, was formed, and Paul Maloney received five of the Fry pollen samples, which were examined by a Shroud conference in Pennsylvania. In the same year, a Shroud symposium was organized by Bill Meacham in Hong Kong, at which I was also able to exhibit the Brooks photographic exhibit, which drew a quarter of a million people in a few days. In 1986 also, Wanger and Wanger demonstrated their polarized image overlay technique, which revolutionized the iconographic study of the Shroud face image. In the same year, the environmental study of the Shroud in Jerusalem, of which I was a member, led by Dr. Eugenia Natovsky, was conducted in a tomb complex under Jerusalem. In 1988, samples were cut, need I tell you, from the Shroud for carbon-14 testing. Rigi also took blood samples and retained a portion of the cut Shroud material. In the same year, Fry's entire collection of samples became the property of ASSIST. These were examined by Dr. Alan Adler and others, revealing plant and floral debris and more pollens. In the same year, in August, I recall, as some of you were, being at a private Shroud group meeting at Dorothy Crispino's home when Rinaldi telephoned from Turin, gravely disturbed that he had been told that the carbon dating results were likely to be a medieval date. And I was interested that Father Fred corroborated that view that I had of Rinaldi after that time in his talk this morning. In October 88, those results were announced by Hall as 1260 to 1390 exclamation mark. In 91, Isabel Pikchek showed conclusively that the image cannot be any kind of painting. In the same year, an international Shroud symposium was held in St. Louis, Missouri, organized by Joe Marino and Father Aram. In 92, five textile experts examined the Shroud. In 93, Garza Valdez examined the Shroud sample retained by Rigi, leading to his observations of bioplastic coating on the fibers. In 95, Cardinal Salderini declared that any Shroud samples other than those taken with official permission in 78 are unauthorized and asked for their return to the Holy See. In 95, Barry Schwartz created the first major Shroud website. And in 97, the Shroud was rescued from certain destruction in the burning and collapsing Turin Cathedral by hero fireman Mario Trematori, who I think has now appeared in the room. Yes. The Shroud, as you know, was examined and found to be undamaged. In 1997, the third International Shroud Symposium of the French group was held in Nice. In 98, an exposition of the Shroud took place, as did another international symposium in Turin. And that included several important exhibitions of Shroud-related material in that city, including the highly significant collection of ex-King Umberto II of Savoy and Pierre's original photographic plates from 1898 and other important artefacts associated with syndonology. In May 1999, a conference on relics was held in Rome, which includes the Shroud and allied cloths, at which Her Royal Highness Princess Maria Gabriella of Savoy gave a significant paper on the Savoy collection. In 1999 also, another International Shroud Conference was held here in Richmond, Virginia, and that included the exhibition of Richard Orareo's wonderful collection, part of which we see in this room tonight. In 2000, the Shroud was again on exposition, and a scientific congress was held in Turin to discuss the past, the present, and the future of the Shroud. And in the same year, a one-week examination of the Shroud took place by a group of Italian scientists initiated by Cardinal Spoleto. The underside of the Shroud cloth was examined with a scanner presided over by Ghiberti, which confirmed, shall we say, what had been observed by Sterp in 1978, but which apparently gained other as yet unannounced data. In 2000, an International Shroud Conference was held at Orvieto, Italy. In this year, 2001, the Shroud was placed in a new storage arrangement and kept flat in a chamber filled with an inert gas to assist in its long-term conservation. And now in 2001, we meet here today, this week, for this international conference in Dallas. So now, at the dawn of a new millennium, thanks to the contributions of a very large number of syndonologists and associated researchers of the first and second waves, some definitive statements can be made, perhaps, about the Shroud and its image and the evidence contained in and upon it. And it's worth drawing attention in giving these statements to the published proceedings of the International Scientific Symposium, which was held by invitation only in Turin in March 2000, under the auspices of the Centro Internazionale di Sindonologia. This significant gathering in Turin, which was attended by some members of this conference, which also included a private hour-long examination of the Shroud itself for that select group, produced some very perceptive and valuable presentations and discussions which help us set a useful benchmark for in Shroud research as we determine the course of future priorities and from which I have drawn some of the statements which follow. Further to this, another important conference was held, as I mentioned, last year in Orvieto, organized by the significant Shroud author Emanuela Marinelli, which reflects the current focus and progress of different areas of contemporary Shroud research in all its multidisciplinary fields by those like you and me and many others all over the world. We must remember that statements we make about the Shroud, based on the huge corpus of knowledge which has been amassed over the last 100 years, are mostly polemical. They are open to varying degrees of argument and varying methods of validation, for as all of us know, there are potentially about as many opinions about each characteristic of the Shroud and as many opinions about each hypothesis accounting for these characteristics as there are Shroud researchers living and working all over the world. Our late friend Al Adler, in his last published work, pointed out that the validation of scientific conclusions differs from the criteria applied to historical arguments in that in science, hypotheses must be tested by a reproducible experiment. He reminded us that scientific studies cannot establish the authenticity of the Shroud, but only its disauthenticity. He noted that in the testing of hypotheses by experiment, the investigator must carry out enough measurements to establish precision and enough control experiments to distinguish which of all reasonable, possible, testable explanations best fits the data. He said, and I quote, "Scientific truth becomes a matter of relative probabilities to which one approximates by the continued application of the scientific method, utilizing further testable hypotheses and experiments," unquote. These statements are supported and reiterated frequently in the contemporary literature as a response to the scene many of us observed at the huge international symposium held in Turin in 1998, at which some quite ridiculous and unsubstantiated and unverifiable papers were put forward, from the extreme outer fringes of syndonology. Although we must bear in mind that everyone who submitted a proposed paper was sincere in their beliefs and was accepted without question to that conference, although, as I recall it, some of our esteemed and legitimate colleagues in syndonology packed up and went home when some of the lightweights took to the podium. This may have been the cause for the current degree of focus on determining the veracity of research. Bruno Barbaris comments, in relation to the image formation process, for example, that serious theoretical and experimental research based on strictly scientific foundations must be applied. This comment demonstrates the difference between developing validation in the sciences and the arts. Regarding the criteria used in the historical arguments, as opposed to scientific method, Adler had already pointed out that reasonable theories, well supported by a great deal of varied historic, artistic, iconographic, and other circumstantial evidence, although remaining polemical, are regarded as acceptable in the determination of Shroud history. But Ghiberti, who identifies a greater problem, takes a harder line. He says that we must work on the problem of the force of habit and conceit in presuming to know, holding sway over contact with serious primary sources. And he calls on the need to rigorously verify on an incontrovertible documentary basis historical descriptions which are made. And Jackson indicated that some of the most compelling historical arguments are based on direct scientific observation of aspects of the Shroud itself. The way forward, he suggests, is through the coupling together of the scientific method, through empirical observation, with the historical data supported by strong circumstantial evidence, which, although in the crucial period before 1350 remains polemical, will hopefully produce a convincing and satisfying history of the Shroud from its origin to the present. To guide us then into the new millennium of research, let's recall some of the main definitive statements of empirical fact and of near certainty, albeit polemical, that can be made confidently about the Shroud, as a result of the combined interdisciplinary approaches of scientific, historical, artistic, religious, iconographic, and other fields of study over the last 100 years. Each of these statements, dare I say, with its own separately evolved methodology for validation, their differences being perhaps the catalyst for many of the greatest disagreements, exclusions, arguments, and jealousies which have occasionally, but perhaps in the long run beneficially, punctuated the work of syndonology in the past. And obviously it's beyond the scope of this paper to cover all the detail which can be derived from the huge corpus of published Shroud research. And so I'm only able to touch upon some of the key arguments and observations to at least give an indication of where we stand now and which will guide our thinking as we contemplate syndonology in the new millennium. We have a quite clear understanding of the cloth itself. I mean, we know with absolute certainty that the major part of the Shroud was manufactured from flax to become a linen cloth in herringbone twill weave, and it's widely accepted that its manufacture is compatible with the skills, methods, style, and technology of and location in first century Palestine. It's also widely accepted that these skills and method and style and technology of manufacture are completely anomalous in the 14th century in Europe, and that there are no similar examples extant from that period. We know with certainty that the backing Holland cloth is medieval in origin and exhibits normal characteristics of medieval textile technology. We know that the side strip, as sampled by Race in 1973, is distinguishably different to the main body of the cloth, which he also sampled because it was sewn on to the edge. We are almost certain that additional strengthening and repair materials, such as cotton threads, which can be observed microscopically on the cloth, have been added long after its time of manufacture, possibly therefore altering the composition of some parts of the cloth. Importantly, it's currently proposed by such as Benford and Marino and Rogers that, based on strong evidence derived from direct observations of pictures and samples, that some secondary reweaving took place in the area of the cloth, which underwent radiocarbon dating in 1988, although further demonstration of this would be helpful. We have a clear, talking of the history of the Shroud, we have a clear documentation of the history from 1350 onwards, since de Charnay owned it, and with some convincing theories suggesting its whereabouts in the short gaps which existed in its documented chronology since that time, which are generally accepted. We have a series of very plausible hypotheses based on the whole range of circumstantial evidence on the Shroud itself in the historical record, through art history and iconography, through the interpretation of religious texts from the eyewitness accounts reported in the New Testament, supporting the prior existence of the Shroud right back to the first century. We know with a high degree of probability that the shroud conforms exactly through analysis of existing complex fold marks with descriptions of a shroud-like object being hoisted up for exposition in Constantinople in the middle of the 12th and probably the 11th centuries, demonstrating strongly the likelihood of its existence well before 1350. We know that it's highly likely that it is the shroud itself which is depicted along with the poker holes on the Hungarian Prey manuscript of 1192 in stone reliefs from 1150, and it's highly likely that the shroud face and the poker holes appear in representations of the cloth of Edessa and in Byzantine coinage back to 944. We know from Wilson and others of the high likelihood that the shroud, the cloth of Edessa, and the Mandylion are the same historical object, demonstrating a date for the shroud back as far as the 500s, based on historical, artistic, iconographic, and other circumstantial evidence, and which indeed Mark Guskin added to in our knowledge in the early documentation yesterday that he gave us. We know certainly that the historical accounts of the Passion of Jesus of Nazareth speak of a shroud used in his burial, which belonged to Joseph of Arimathea, placing such an object in the correct context of the time and place of the entombment of the body of Jesus. We know with absolute certainty that the bloodstains on the shroud are composed of real human blood and the blood-derived materials of the blood group type AB. It's almost universally accepted that these stains were transferred onto the shroud by direct contact between a deceased human corpse and the cloth, because they've been established as post-mortem blood flows and the stains are not in stereo register with the body images. It's almost universally accepted that these blood flows are derived from injuries which comply forensically with the written historical accounts of the Passion and the Crucifixion of Jesus of Nazareth, and that some of the injuries revealed by the bloodstains, especially the crown of thorns, are unique to the Passion and death of Christ in the historical record. We know with certainty that the bloodstains were transferred onto the cloth before any image formation of the man in the shroud took place. It's widely accepted through direct experimental evidence that the pattern of blood flows in the head region of the image conform exactly with the highly complex bloodstains observed on the cloth of Oviedo, whose existence is historically proven back to at least the 7th century, and therefore both cloths must have been imprinted with blood from the same corpse and at the same point in historical time. And we also know now from this conference a great deal more about the cloth of Argenteuil. We know with absolute certainty that the body image is not the product of human artistic endeavour. This has been demonstrated through rigorous testing of all known artistic criteria and convincingly presented time and time again, especially by Isabel Pikchek, and is scientifically proven through chemical analysis and observation recently summarised by Adler. We know with certainty that the image lies only on the topmost exposed fibrils of the fibres of the weave and penetrates no deeper. We know with certainty that the body image shows the exact forensic accuracy of the wounds, correct medical proportions of the body shape to be expected of a flogged and crucified man aged in his 30s, laid out in death, despite the arguments for and against distortion of the cloth itself. It's widely accepted that the man in the image conforms with the expected physical characteristics of a Sephardic Jew of first century Palestine, irrespective of whether he's supposed to have been tall or short. We know with certainty that the body image was transferred onto the cloth by a completely independent process from the transfer of blood, and some types of imposed linear field is implied because of the absence of image formation to the sides of the body shape. We know with certainty that the image has the properties of a photographic negative, whereby many of its visually observable characteristics are revealed when seen in photographic negative form. We know with certainty that the image is coded in three dimensions and exhibits this three-dimensionality only when processed through a VP8 image analyzer or other instruments employing appropriate algorithms for 3D image analysis, and the image of no other object does so without distortion. It's widely accepted that photographs by Henriot in 1931 reveal details which cannot be readily observed in later photographs, suggesting the possible deterioration of the shroud image since that time. We know that the cloth carries a wide variety of particulate matter, surface pollutants and other indicators, such as burn marks, water stains, poker holes, fold marks, DNA traces and other historical indicators on its surface, from which much historical evidence can be corroborated. We know with certainty that the cloth carries specific pollens on its surface, which are unique to Palestine and Turkey, indicating that the shroud must have been in those places. And the historical record confirms that this could not have taken place after 1350, demonstrating firstly the plausibility of its earlier existence, and secondly its provenance to the correct geographic location and possibly even the time period for direct association with the entombment of Jesus of Nazareth. It's been demonstrated by direct microscopic examination of samples that a dirt mark on the heel of 1 foot area on the surface of the cloth contains particles of calcite and aragonite, which have been identified as unique to geological limestone formations in the area of Jerusalem, suggesting an association between the cloth and the limestone cut tombs of Jerusalem in use in the first century. This is done by Natoski and her colleagues, and I helped to collect the samples. It's generally accepted that human DNA traces have been detected on the surface of the cloth and that a whole range of different DNA got onto it throughout its history. It's widely accepted that a complex pattern of fold marks on the shroud conform to a range of patterns of folding the cloth since 1350, supported by direct historical evidence, and prior to 1350, supported by extensive circumstantial evidence, suggesting that the shroud and the cloth of Edessa are the same historical object. It's widely accepted that the coin images are present as part of the body image over the eyes, and that these are Roman colonial coins of the Emperor Tiberius, minted in the year 29. It's suggested by observation of the Henriet photographs that flower and plant images appear on the cloth, detectable by the use of polarizing filters, and that these correspond with the significant pollen accumulations on the shroud surface, and that they are most likely to have been formed in the same process which transferred the body and the coin images, and the work of Wanger and Dunin and Paul Maloney's oil lamp described to us only this week. It's claimed through direct microscopic analysis that a bioplastic coating exists on the surface of the fibres of the cloth. It's widely accepted that much other particulate matter on the cloth is the residue of direct contact with other objects such as silk wrapping, cloth, paintings and so on. Natoski has published 106 colour photographs of highly magnified microscopic observations of some of the 1978 samples, and these include her identification of body tissue, of blood, of burial spices, contaminants, image, calcium, pollens and fibres. It's widely accepted that a single and constant received likeness of Christ has been handed down through art since at least the 6th century, and it's highly likely that primary or subsequent observations of the shroud face were prototypes for this artistic tradition. It's strongly suggested that certain untypical, anomalous, extant, possibly late 1st century frescoes of Christ found in the Roman catacombs conform with the face image on the shroud, demonstrating that they're likely to be representations of the same man, thus dating possible observations of the shroud to the 1st century. It's generally accepted that the great proportion of iconic pictures of Jesus of Nazareth and representations of the Mandylion and Edessa face seem to be derived from the shroud image, given the high number of recurring points of congruence of these images where compared directly to the shroud image face, the work of Wanger, Manton and others. Hundreds of examples in iconography, numismatics, sculpture and other artistic forms throughout the first millennium show high levels of congruity with the shroud face image. Now, we all know that the radiocarbon dating test of 1988 achieved a date for the sample area of cloth for 1260 to 1390, and we must assume that it was achieved with good precision, or that it probably was, given the methodology is problematic in the case of old linen. But it's now widely accepted through direct scientific measurement that the one piece of the shroud which was cut into samples and radiocarbon dated by the three laboratories shows a completely different microspectroscopic chemical structure to other measured areas of the main body of the cloth, demonstrating a different composition, and that the sample area is therefore atypical of the shroud, and that as a consequence, if the dating study can claim good precision for its reported date, the radiocarbon test cannot assign any accuracy to the date of the whole cloth, because it is not clearly established that the location is typical of the whole cloth, as Adler pointed out to us. It is currently postulated on the basis of direct microscopic observation that the exact area of the radiocarbon dating sample contains threads of cotton, possible evidence of reweaving in this part of the cloth at a time later than its original manufacture, suggesting that it's not typical. It's also currently postulated that the fire of 1532 could have caused multi-century shifts in the C14 contained on the cloth, and we've heard only this week about the effect of waterborne salts by Brian Walsh on the dating, and it was also postulated that any number of a range of contaminants could have affected the dating, as we heard yesterday and today from Marie-Claire Oosterwijk-Gostouche, and yet still we are unable to state with absolute certainty what is the exact nature of the body image, what process formed it, why it has the properties of a photographic negative, why it has three-dimensional and other singular phenomena associated with it, or how it comes to have anatomical and other data encoded in it, unknown in the Middle Ages and certainly unknown at the time of Christ. And despite this, there are still some flat earthers, and I have to say I put that phrase into my paper before I heard Paul Maloney speaking the other day, who would claim and even publish that it was made by someone as a fake, a dupe, a sideshow exhibit, a confidence trick with little reason for doing so in the Middle Ages. It cannot be satisfactorily reproduced by any known method even now at the beginning of the 21st century, despite having witnessed the most spectacular advances in science and technology of all history in the last generation. We see absurd, ugly, and crude reproductions claiming to be produced by that same mechanism, whatever it may be, as the shroud image. Many such theories abound about the shroud, but nonetheless, they all need assessment. There are several of the most plausible formation images which need to be thoroughly examined or re-examined and tested with our rapidly expanding technological possibilities in this new millennium. Amongst them are Wachringer was the first person who talked about cellulose degradation of the fibres in botanical specimens preserved in paper in 1942 and was published in my daughter's English translation in 1991, subsequently supported by the work of Jackson and others. Rodanti's theory of contact transference of chemical substances present on the corpse, and now Mattingly's proposals of the oxidization of bacterial fatty acids. Notovsky's effect of ambient microclimatic conditions in the burial chamber upon substances on the corpse. Igor Benson and Wanger's coronal discharge through the body caused by the effect of lightning generating radiation images. Lindner's theory that electron radiation caused reactions in the cellulose, which have been supported by Volkovsky's paper read by PicCheck this week, and biophoton emissions of all bodies. And those who tend towards the thermonuclear flash radiation by an as yet unidentified mechanism to generate the image, and there have been many people who proposed that, and postulated by Moran this week as a change in gravity medium, or by Gil Lavoie as radiation from a vertically placed body. And just because science, as defined by scientists, cannot explain nor admit the nature of apparently miraculous occurrences, is hardly enough reason for discarding consideration of such possibilities in a world where it in a world where the impossible becomes the possible on a daily basis. And so several key areas of our research which must be addressed to allow us to move forward in the new millennium. We must revisit the issue of radiocarbon dating as a very high priority. This is essential because, as Meacham has so clearly pointed out this week and in Turin, many of the general public who do not necessarily understand the subject as we do regard the October 88 announcement of the dating of the shroud as the point of closure for the debate, which, if true, would consign so much of our work to the garbage bin of history. Meacham also claimed that the handling of the C-14 testing was a debacle, and he was one of the very few who predicted its probable failure from the outset of the debate in the early 80s. After the event, of course, many shroudies struggled to comprehend how a radiocarbon date announced so smugly and in such contempt of the sensibilities of religion, history and science by Tite and Hall could be possible in the face of the mass of shroud knowledge which had been born of a century of research and observation. The reported date was totally incongruous to most of us and a complete anomaly when set against all the other massive assemblage of evidence to the contrary. And as Meacham points out, the resolution of this conflict remains a vital and crucial issue for syndonologists of the new millennium. There are others who hold out hope that a single thread might one day be satisfactory sample size to redo the C-14 experiment, and it's said that plenty of residual single threads lie even now in the secret archives of a number of those who've had access to the cloth over the years, although none of these could now be accepted as having original uncontaminated provenance. Some argue that a radiocarbon test is totally inappropriate for a textile which has been exposed to so much disturbance over such a long period as this one has. Many argue that a radiocarbon testing was unwise and preemptive, telling us more perhaps about our own arrogance, our search for a once and for all solution to the riddle of the shroud, than about the shroud itself, and that because it was a one-off unverifiable test, which is unlikely ever to be repeated, unless a procedure requiring minute samples, sample sizes is invented, and the protocol itself is undertaken in a far more comprehensive and transparent manner, that this only demonstrates that one very small corner snippet cut off the shroud was dated to that date for some reason or another and cannot be assigned to the whole cloth. This is probably what should have been pointed out in October 1988, for it was never established that the location sample was typical of the rest of the cloth. The future of that debate needs to address the issue from the point of view that it's the cloth itself which contains characteristics which may defy a meaningful C14 result rather than conspiracy theories or alleged incompetencies in actually carrying out the measurements themselves. All of this shows that we must find out once and for all why the anomaly of the radiocarbon date contradicts so much other data. We must evaluate and test the current hypotheses which could explain it. The continuation of the work of the late Alan Adler and others regarding the variations in the microspectroscopy results observable across the shroud must be encouraged. The degree to which the bioplastic coating observed by Garcia Valdez on the thread fibres must also be further explored. We should take into account the opinions of other contemporaries, such as Antonacci, who have considered the C14 polemic. Adler says that further radiocarbon dating of the shroud should not be carried out until we readily understand why the present study failed. Meacham states again that the C14 dates have been given hugely disproportionate importance by the general public and intellectuals, whilst being given too little importance by some shroud researchers. Let us hope, he says, that the shroud studies can begin the new millennium with new C14 data. So far from being the point of closure for the debate about the history of the shroud, the carbon date is in fact an opening for a whole period of new research and experiment. And who knows, the outcome might lead to a complete review of the science of radiocarbon dating of textiles and fire-damaged objects. But because that did not solve the mystery or end the debate or consign people like you and me to the lunatic fringe of flat earthers who are onto a loser, as Hall said in 1988, but instead demonstrated once more that a multidisciplinary approach is needed when assessing the characteristics of the shroud, by focusing our attention on the real issues derived from the arts, history and the sciences, which only in combination can answer the outstanding questions of the shroud, one can feel confident that many of the third wave of syndonologists will therefore make great progress in the years ahead by taking up this challenge. There is also much to be done in other areas. The emphasis in recent years has been on the conservation of the shroud. Science has learned what religion already knew, that the shroud, whatever its provenance, is a unique and special object which is precious beyond description and must be preserved, protected and conserved. As the new millennium dawned, contemporary conservation ideas caught up at last with the shroud. But as with all aspects of shroud study, agreement over appropriate storage and conservation requirements for it took a long time to be reached. It's certainly a step forward that it's now maintained in a controlled environment and kept flat. There are some who propose that the image will shortly disappear altogether, and they may be right, although I must remind you that I commented during the International Press Conference in Turin in 1998 as one of the few present who had seen the shroud, both in 1978 and in 1998, that my subjective observation was that the image looked better 20 years later. But that may have been a view that some would relegate to the onset of senility or an unlikely improvement in my eyesight. It seems unlikely that the experts and the custodians will agree on protocols for further testing unless these are presented by a unified and comprehensive group of top-line researchers who have demonstrated that the envisaged tests will be non-intrusive and will be broadly beneficial to future research. It would be unfortunate to undertake tests which will not yield data which is widely available to all, or which simply repeat aspects of previous testing if there is no need for further verification of those earlier ones. We are in general agreement that future direct testing of the cloth will have to be unintrusive. The tests we may devise must not harm the cloth or deplete the evidence contained in and on it. Some of us of the second wave and some of you of the third are engaged in a major effort to define and propose whole fields of new constructive testing procedures, which might clarify, for example, the nature of the image itself and will hopefully lead to a better understanding of its formation process. Jackson, reflecting the views of many, pointed out that finding a satisfactory mechanism for the origin of the shroud image has shown itself to be a complex and difficult problem. We know that a large number of hypotheses exist which can generally or partly explain that process, but nearly all of these fail to account for the properties of the image. Nearly every speaker at the Turin Scientific Symposium of March 2000, and many at the Orvieto conference made the same observation. Therefore, a new series of tests and measurements will have to be undertaken sooner or later by a research team, and this will probably take years of planning and require a spirit of generosity and friendship which reaches far beyond our own egos and the advancement of our own pet theories. Many syndonologists have observed that new technologies are available, coupled with the incredible advances that we have today in data retrieval, storage and interpretation by, for example, digital computer systems, and that the appropriate applications of these technologies to the shroud might reveal new information, allowing us a better understanding of that formation process. But it would be unfortunate to undertake tests which will not yield data which is widely available to all or are simply repeating aspects of previous testing. Because if this were to be the way forward, we would be no wiser in another 100 years. You'll recall that further tests on the shroud itself were suspended by the authorities for a long time in view of the acrimonious exchanges amongst the experts since the last round. There are still many political mysteries surrounding the shroud, many intrigues and plots, cover-ups and scandals, and many big egos are involved. Here then are some examples of the proposed tests based on the most contemporary available literature. Adler recommends a biological assay for the microflora and microfauna. He also recommends the application of improved spectroscopic instruments to better understand the chemical structures on the cloth. Wilson has called for a spectroscopic analysis of the poker holes to determine the specific regional geological signature on the black pitch substance found in those areas, and that's been supported by Schwartz. Adler calls for surface pH measurements to be taken. Jenkins suggests a further range of X-ray radiography and fluorescence experiments. Others suggest that a complete colour map of the shroud be obtained through a mobile imaging radiometer. Balasino demonstrates the importance of computer science through digital imaging of the shroud. Vercelli places at the disposal of experts an exact reproduction of cloth sample with the same textile characteristics. Meacham calls for a few grams of the cloth from 6 new locations, coupled with the latest technology to conduct new radiocarbon tests. Ivanov calls for a more accurate examination of the molecule isotope structure of the fabric, including those not containing carbon. Brian Walsh calls for further work on the carbon gradient. And, of course, from the point of view of history and iconography, the historical detectives must be encouraged to continue their arduous task. There is more work to be done to strengthen further the case of circumstantial evidence supporting shroud history prior to 1350. It's surely only a matter of time before somebody comes up with hard evidence proving beyond dispute the whereabouts of the shroud at some time in the first millennium. All the signs are there. Maybe we'll find more clues amongst the ruins of Edessa or in Constantinople or tucked away in some medieval manuscript as yet unseen in a hidden ancient library. Syndonologists of the third wave can take the example of those who continue to lead the debate in pre-1350 shroud historical studies. It's also important to continue to develop a global index or archive of the vast mass of shroud material spawned in the past 100 years. There are now so many thousands of books and papers, articles, published proceedings, photographs, videos, websites, research group and society newsletters in so many languages reflecting syndonology that is beyond the scope of any single mind to accommodate anything like all of them. And so part of our way forward must be to collaborate, to share, to advise, to seek peer review, to offer viewpoints, to remain open to the findings of others, and to realise that it's teamwork at the local, national and international levels which will overcome the danger of individual research being lost in the mass. We must be vigilant in our desire to encourage legitimate research. We must be vigilant, albeit with compassion, in our desire to sort out the straw from the chaff and to separate the distractions of the sideshows from the action of the main arena, and to draw each other's attention to the credible and plausible. Remember, as Richard Arario said yesterday, the best of the shroud is yet to come. And so therefore, these, it seems to me, are the major issues which represent our way forward into the new millennium. First, we must focus on the contemporary issues as defined at conferences like this one. We must resolve the radiocarbon polemic once and for all. We must encourage those who seek to explain the image formation process. We must inspire the historical detectives not to give up their arduous search. We must unite internationally in devising a new and beneficial round of direct testing based on the huge advances in technology since 1978. We must assemble our corpus of knowledge of the Shroud into an accessible database for the benefit of all through the websites, the museums, and the collections. We must demonstrate absolutely our good intentions and goodwill towards those charged with the onerous responsibility for allowing or denying access to the cloth in the 21st century. We must embrace teamwork and encourage peer review in all our work. We must remain focused on the need for a multidisciplinary approach. We must seek high standards of verification for our claims. We must sustain and support those of the younger generation who represent the third wave of syndonology to take up our work and continue the research. Let us look back this evening with pride and satisfaction over the work we have done in the last century. And let us remember with affection those who have made their contribution and are now gone. Let us also look forward, turning to the sons and daughters of the first and second waves. Let us be positive and remain challenged and excited. Let us be inspired by this extraordinary piece of linen, which has not only survived the last 25 years of malicious controversy, criticism, lampooning, ignorance, personal grandstanding and sensationalism, but has survived perhaps 2,000 years of abuse and damage and attack and often negligence, and yet remains the greatest single mystery on earth and attracts more attention than any other object in existence, and which for a century has brought people like you and me together in our quest to unlock its mysteries. And let us once more think deeply, each one of us, about the implications of the Shroud and how it touches our hearts and our souls, and continue to consider what this object really means and what it tells us about the message of the man it represents. Here, where religion, the arts, and the sciences collide, lies, does it not, a vessel of great hope, containing a message of enormous power and an expression of enormous love. And it's up to us to harness this same love, which brings us all together in places here, like here in Dallas, Texas, and at every other Shroud convention or conference over the world, and at every Shroud exposition or meeting, to remember and learn from the message which lies within that enigmatic image as we continue to unlock its secrets. And as Father Fred Brinkman reminded us so eloquently this morning, try to bring healing and goodwill to all Shroudies everywhere. Once more, I must thank the organizers of this conference for showing us, by holding it in these difficult times, that free peoples like us will not be forced into hiding by terrorists to dwell in the murky shadows as they themselves do, but rather to stand in the light and celebrate what is good, to celebrate what unites us, and try to be conciliatory about the issues that might divide us. If so many thousands of people in the world, regardless of their religion, their age group, their background, their training, their nationality, or any other apparent difference, are united in their quest for the truth about this extraordinary and unique object, surely it simply cannot be some kind of monstrous fraud. And finally, my brothers and sisters, may I thank all of you for the great honor you have granted me in being able to deliver this humble keynote address to you on this auspicious occasion tonight, and therefore giving me the opportunity to attempt to take stock of our hopes and dreams for the Shroud in the new millennium.
From Shroud University, this is Russ Brialt. I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast, and we hope you stop back from time to time and see what else is new. Also, check out Shroud University itself with all kinds of videos, audios, video blogs, and pretty much everything you can think of related to the Shroud of Turin, the greatest mystery in the known world.